Hello, and welcome to the Innovation Forum podcast for Friday, 1st of February, with me, Ian Welsh. As usual, coming up is our news digest and some information on what's coming up for us at Innovation Forum this spring. Our highlight this week is a wide-ranging interview with Louise Nichols, Marks & Spencer's Head of Human Rights, Food Sustainability and Food Packaging, whom I met this week to discuss M&S's new plastic take-back scheme and how the food sector is adapting their supply chains to ensure long-term supply security and sustainability. So do keep listening. Next, though, is a regular review of what's happening in business and sustainability. The annual World Economic Forum meeting in Davos generated the usual flurry of report launches amid the schmoozing for the great and the good this week. The Ellen MacArthur Foundation has published a Cities and a Circular Economy for Food report that points at how a linear food supply system has had significant negative environmental and social impacts, arguing that for every dollar spent on food, government and civil society have to spend $2 to mitigate the negative effects that food products have on human health, the environment and the economy. The report estimates that half of a total cost of $11.4 trillion can be linked directly to linear food supply chains. Instead, as you'd expect from the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, the report proposes a move to a circular model with benefits of $2.7 trillion if the world's food systems are made circular, with all food products either eaten, composted or somehow fed back into the system. The greatest potential would come from creating circular systems in cities. Around one-third of food is currently wasted, estimates suggest. And the report also argues that there are $550 billion of healthcare savings to be made from reducing pesticide and antibiotic use in food supply chains. Also at Davos, Google, along with the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, launched a new study into how artificial intelligence could provide savings of up to $220 billion a year by helping to design out waste in the food and the consumer electronics sectors. Delivering circular economy at scale, AI can innovate and improve the logistics and infrastructure required to close the loop on products and materials. For the food sector, the research suggests that AI can, for example, develop better recipes and greater use of plant-based ingredients that combine to cut waste. Ellen MacArthur Foundation didn't have the monopoly in circular economy type initiatives at Davos, with the backing of some of the biggest consumer goods companies, including Procter & Gamble, Nestle, PepsiCo and Unilever. Recycler TerraCycle launched a new initiative called Loop. This would allow consumers to shop using durable, refillable packaging, which is collected, cleaned and reused. The aim is to reduce reliance on single-use packaging. Consumers will be able to shop directly from Loop's website for delivery and collection, via partner retailers, or in-store, where customers can buy products as normal and then bring back the empty containers when they next visit. All packaging will have a deposit return scheme, incentivizing the customer to give the packaging back. Pilot schemes are due to launch in France and parts of the US in the spring, and in the UK later in the year. Another pilot was launched this week by UK retailer Marks & Spencer's, which has set up a plastic return scheme in 8 stores where customers can bring plastic packaging currently not collected by local authority curbside recycling schemes, including crisp packets, black ready meal trays and sauce sachets. The material is used to make store fixtures and playground equipment for schools. For more on this, stay listening for my interview with Marks & Spencer's Louise Nichols, which is coming up later in the podcast. Elsewhere this week, investors have been calling on some of the world's biggest food businesses to publish detail on how they will mitigate environmental risks such as deforestation and water stress in their supply chains. Over 80 investors with more than $6.5 trillion of assets under management, led by Business Coalition Series and the FAIR initiative from Coller Capital, have sent an open letter to McDonald's, Domino's, Yum Brands, Chipotle, Wendy's and Burger King owner Restaurant Brands International, stating that animal agriculture is the world's highest emitting sector without a low carbon plan. The investors are asking for deadline-driven targets for cutting greenhouse gas emissions in supply chains, with publicly disclosed progress reported on an annual basis. They point out that carbon emissions from agriculture could eat up 70% of global carbon budgets by 2050, which coincides with when the global population will grow past 10 billion. The investors want all fast food brands to comply with the reporting recommendations of the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures, which provides for scenario analysis of the impacts climate change will have on company operations. Fast food brands have, of course, significant coffee supply chains, a sector where the Fair Trade mark has had a strong presence for some time. But how much of the Fair Trade premium filters through to farmers? Not that much, according to a new paper from the German Institute for Economic Research. Titled, Where Does the Fair Trade Money Go?, the research says that only a fifth of the typical $1 per pound premium paid by the consumer reaches the producer, with the rest going to roasters and the other many hands the product passes through along the supply chain. UK businesses that are subject to the reporting requirements of the Modern Slavery Act may find that they have to do more to comply if the interim recommendations of a parliamentary review are enacted. MPs commissioned by the UK government to investigate how the Act might be more effective have made a number of suggestions. Among these are that companies should be mandated to report more information about labour risks, that reporting only that a company has taken no action on modern slavery is no longer sufficient, and changing the rules that a company must consider its entire supply chain. And finally this week, fashion brand Tommy Hilfiger has unveiled a 100% recycled pair of jeans, the world's first if the brand's PR is correct. The garments are made from cotton offcuts that are mechanically separated and woven into new material. Thread comes from recycled plastic, and the buttons and zips from recycled metal. The line's launch follows 3 years of research at the Denim Centre in Amsterdam, which is owned by PVH Corp, Tommy Hilfiger's parent company, and specialises in developing low-carbon, low-water processes for closed-loop garments. Save £300 this week on tickets for Innovation Forum's new London Future Food Conference this coming 4th and 5th of June. Already confirmed to join us are experts from the likes of Unilever, PepsiCo, Nestle, Ferraro, ING, Marks & Spencer and Carlsberg. Hope to see you there. Interview time now. Joining Innovation Forum in London for the Future Food event in June will be Louise Nichols, Marks & Spencer's Head of Human Rights, Food Sustainability and Food Packaging. A few days ago, I met with her at Marks & Spencer's London headquarters, and we talked about the brand's new plastic take-back scheme, modern slavery risks, and what retailers have to do to develop properly resilient supply chains. Marks & Spencer's has just released or just announced a new initiative to trial plastic-free aisles in a store in London. What's that all about?
Really what this is about, Ian, if we just go back to this time last year, we were really thinking about how do we step on our approach to plastics. As part of that, we started to think out what would be the game-changing initiatives. And one of them was, how did we change the dynamic around really encouraging people to look at unwrapped fruit and veg? And so the trial that we've launched in Tolworth is over 90 fresh fruit and veg lines are unwrapped, so that the feel when you walk into the store is really different. Lots of open, colourful fruit and veg. Where we have had to involve some packaging, they're in pulp trays, so in the form of soft fruit where it needs something and open. And then what we're offering is either paper bags or we're offering reusable bags to encourage people to then take it to the till and weigh it. And then instead of plastic barcode labels, they are paper labels. We've introduced trained greengrocers. And the main reason for that is to really engage in the conversation with customers about encouraging them to try the unwrapped version and also to give some advice around how to ensure that they store it in the best way to extend the product life. We've also taken away the date codes, and we've done that because we've got a belief that customers are potentially throwing away perfectly edible fruit and veg because they think it's gone past the code. So again, we're using the greengrocers to really encourage customers to be able to spot the signs of fresh fruit and veg. And again, just really take people back to how things would have been in the past and help people reconnect with fruit and veg.
Is that the problem, that people have sort of lost that connection with what they're buying?
People are just less sure, I think, about fruit and veg. So, you know, the reality that I'm sure you would do at home is that just because you had one raspberry that was perhaps looking a little bit past its best, that doesn't mean all the other raspberries in the punnet are past their best. So it's just trying to help people connect and to change some of those perceptions. And the reason why we've made it a 3-month trial is we reckon that there's a bit of a journey to go on with customers about helping to encourage them. Because obviously, weighing things takes a little bit longer. It's not as quick. It's helping people to spend that little bit longer, perhaps try some different fruit and veg. And obviously the advantage of weighing it yourself is you get just the right quantities. And it's exactly the same price per kilogram, so it's no different on price. It's coming through exactly the same supply chain. And this was really important to us. What we didn't do was to create a special model store. We said we wanted to use our existing systems, work very closely with our suppliers, get the suppliers to come into store, help train the greengrocers, really start to think how much further down the supply chain we could take the same thinking and apply it.
So what sort of impact would this have if you're able to roll this out to your stores across the UK?
What it is it's a 3-month trial, because what we want to do is we want to learn and evolve the process. And of course we won't get everything right first time, but this is about evolving the process. What can we do with the way that we package on the way to store to extend the life? What could we do in the store to potentially extend the life overnight? So it's really starting to get us to think differently and think perhaps much more like old-fashioned greengrocers, which
are done. I mean, I guess the big challenge for a food retailer is going to be ensuring that in a move away from plastic, there isn't an increase in food waste. How much do you recognise that as the key to this issue?
Yeah, I think absolutely key here is that there's been a certain element of demonising plastic, and we have to be really clear. Packaging played a really key role in helping to extend product life and helping to keep the quality of it. And inevitably, that's about helping to reduce food waste. So I think it's about finding the right balance. And what does that right balance look like? And obviously, very, very perishable fruit and veg salad may always need to have an element of packaging on it, particularly if it's going to be prepared. But I think it's understanding how far can we switch the balance. And so this is part of a much bigger piece that M&S is doing. So what we set ourselves the goal is to say that how could we remove 1,000 tonnes of plastic from the supply chain, which we will have done by spring of this year. And that's 5% of our plastic packaging. And we've set ourselves the same goal to reduce by another 5% next year. And we've really done that by actually starting to get the product design teams to think about where could we absolutely stop using packaging? Where could we fundamentally redesign the way we think about packaging? How could we reduce the packaging? And then we've got a bold commitment that we will get to 100% recyclability by 2022. So how are we going to ensure that that packaging is recyclable? And then it's about how could we increase the recycled content of it? Another area that everybody's quite concerned about is all those packaging items that are currently not recyclable, and of which the black tray is the demonised one. So again, we've been working very hard on how we remove those non-recyclable elements. So we've kind of phased out a black out of fruit and veg. You've seen our kind of mini bite tubs have all moved to clear. You've seen that we've introduced two ranges of meals that have come out of black, again, into a move to clear. So that's 1,700 tonnes of black to clear plastic. But again, really challenging ourselves further. And what we were hearing from customers, in the same way what we're hearing from customers is, I'd really like to see my fruit and veg unwrapped. What we're hearing from customers is this whole process of working out what, whether or not my plastic is recyclable or not recyclable, it's really, really difficult. And we know that it's partly really, really difficult because if we go up and down the country, all the local authorities have slightly different approaches, which really doesn't help the customer. So we thought, well, what could we do about that? How could we kind of change that dynamic? And so the initiative that we're introducing this week is Plastic Take-Back Scheme. We're initially introducing that into 8 stores, and actually I was at one of those stores this morning at Tolworth, where it's interesting, even without going out with the marketing, the bin is full. And what it's enabling customers to bring back is the things that they don't believe are recyclable. So we've, of course, seen the black tray in there, we're seeing film, we're seeing crisp packets, we're seeing beauty products come back. But we're also seeing in the bin things that are recyclable by their local authority. So part of this is going to be working with the local authority to help educate residents about the things that are recyclable in their area. The other thing that we've done is we've teamed up with Wastebusters, which is an education charity. And we're engaging with schools. So initially for this 8-store trial with 20 primary schools. And there what we've done is put together with Wastebusters. They've got the same collection device operating so that the schools can start to bring back the bits of plastic they don't believe are recyclable. But it's also supported with school assemblies, homework, selfie programs to encourage people to take a selfie as they're donating their plastic. But what we're going to do with it is we're going to demonstrate that this plastic is recyclable. So whatever you bring back into the store, what we're going to do is at night, we're going to colour sort it. And then working with Dow, who are the other part of the partnership, we're going to take back that plastic. We're going to produce it into plastic board. And then that plastic board will be used to produce some of the bins that you're going to see in store. But actually, really excitingly, it's going to be used to produce school playground equipment. And obviously what happens for the schools that part of the initiatives is that they get some of that school playground equipment.
That sounds great. So what's the incentive for consumers to come and give you back their plastic? Is there a financial incentive in this, or is it
just... There isn't a financial incentive, and that's partly because what we're seeing is that customers actually want to bring it in They feel very, very strongly about it. And that's right. What we see as our key role here is to help educate, because clearly there is a certain element that people just don't understand what is recyclable. And, you know, we sit on the board of OPRL. We're involved in a whole range of initiatives like Plastic Pack and working with the BRC and Ink Pen, etc. But what we need to do here is really get to the heart of what is it the customers don't understand and how can we change that dynamic. And that's what's really quite important. And so the key reason for teaming up with Wastebusters is to help educate that next generation. But also, we're really honest, this is also about Pester Power. How can they engage with their parents and that wider community? And how do we start sending a common message that we really want to increase the recyclability of that plastic?
I guess it's an investment for you guys. I mean, you're not going to make any much return on this, even if there's some value in the products you're collecting. How can you roll this across the whole country? Is this something that we can see in every store eventually?
That's the plan, is to roll out those bins during 2019. And the whole piece here is, this is also part of, whilst also being part of all the different public consultations that are going on and part of those other collaborations, how do we shift the system? And we're shifting the system towards getting to the point that we've got 100% recyclability for 2022. And then it's going to be about, how do we absolutely close the loop? And almost what we're doing with the plastic take back is demonstrating plastic can have another life. At the moment, it's demonised. That's the association everybody's got. But actually, plastic can play a really key role. And actually, if you can close the loop, it need not be harmful for the environment.
The future for packaging in general, then, how are you cutting the plastic in your kind of broader packaging use?
What we've done is every area which is where packaging isn't recyclable, we've got an action plan on it. So obviously, I've talked to you about what we're doing on black. I've talked to you about what we're doing in terms of reducing the amount of plastic. We're also trying to encourage more reusability. So the veg bag is a good example of that. We're looking at some other examples of reusability to, again, just encourage customers to think they've got quite used to now bringing the carrier bag. What else could they be bringing? They've got much more used to the reusable cup, but how else could we extend that same thinking? And obviously, the other key area that we've been working on is reducing single-use plastics. So we phased out the plastic cutlery and introduced the wood cutlery. We've phased out the plastic straws and we've introduced paper straws. We've phased out plastic that was involved in tea bags in terms of the glue to not having that. So that's kind of some of the areas that we're really focusing on.
Okay. Wearing your human rights hat, this week, of course, we had the problem for the Spice Girls and their T-shirts that were being manufactured in Bangladesh on poverty wages and everything else. It's obviously a reminder for brands that, you know, with complicated supply chains, that there are human rights issues that need to be aware of and forced labour issues as well. How is the sector in general continuing the fight against modern slavery? I mean, I know you're partnering with the Gangmaster Authority here in the UK, but generally, what are you doing in modern slavery right now?
Our key focus is absolutely to try and understand where your human rights risks are in the supply chain. And I think for many that feels an overwhelmingly scary thing to say. And I think my key part here is always to get started. This is about really understanding where your first tier supply chain is, and then it's starting to understand the second and the third tier. And by getting that kind of level of transparency, and you can see that by looking at the Marks & Spencer's transparency map, as we've kind of extended that to fish, you can see how we started to take that same thinking further down the tiers. And then I think it's really about, what else are you using besides the audits that you might be doing or the form of assessment? What other external indices are you using to build up a picture of what's going on in your supply chain? How are you reaching out to understand what it feels like to be a worker working in your supply chain and the possible unintended impacts that might be happening on the supply chain, and kind of pulling that information to give you a really informed position? My point is, it's about starting. You know, we're never going to be able to tackle everywhere, but if we focus on where we perceive the biggest, highest priority areas in terms of impact on people, and then really focus on what we can do about it. And again, the key bit here is recognizing that no business can draw a line around their own clean bit. This is about really understanding who can you collaborate with to really drive traction. So we're really involved with FNET, which is, again, bringing together other like-minded businesses that want to really start to understand what their risks might look like further down the supply chain and try and come together where we can to collaborate. We're working with the likes of Psy, again, coming together with the likes of Nestle and Kraft and others to, again, really work on key commodity raw material supply chains, again, helping us to start to track understanding the movement of labour. And the really key bit here, as we face into an even tightening labour market, is understanding that just because you've put in place some checks and balances, as the labour market tightens, there will be new ways of exploiting people, new potential risks. And what you've got to have is a really eyes wide open to what those potential risks might look like, and making sure that the due diligence you've got in place is effective. And so again, that's what we're doing. We're working very much with the Responsible Leadership Group, which is really helping us to look at responsible recruitment, to really understand where recruitment fees might be being utilised. And again, this is not necessarily the direct fees to get a job, but if it requires people to pay transport costs to move from one location to another location, if they don't have that ready fund, who've they gone to borrow the money, and what does that mean? What level of indebtedness might they have arrived to a location with, and therefore how much more vulnerable might they be to exploitation by another third party?
Sure. I mean, the whole modern slavery debate does feel like it's a constantly evolving picture, as you said, and it's one that businesses now really have to be on top of and accept that it's in their supply chain. Forward-thinking businesses really have to say, this isn't our supply chain, we just have to go and find it. And any business that says, we don't have any modern slavery, is really not looking at their supply chain properly. And of course, these risks are all part of evolving supply chains to ensure that there's a sustainable future for supply chains. So perhaps you can think a bit more about the future for supply chains, and particularly around food. How do agricultural supply chains have to evolve, do you think, to ensure that we do have a long-term future where we can feed a growing population in a sustainable way? What are the kind of headline issues for you?
I think there's a recognition that purely incremental changes on their own are probably not going to get us to where we need to. And we're going to start to need to think about much more disruptive solutions to get us to the endpoints. I think you can have a sense of how people's mindsets are shifting. I think from the recognition that AI is going to be an increasing part of business decisions, and I think the point here is that doesn't mean that there won't be jobs for humans. I think the jobs are going to be different, and that actually this is about embracing what this new technology gives us. The machines can only do that kind of smart process if they've got really good data. And this links us to that kind of point about we need better transparency. We also need much better quality data, because that data insight drives us opportunities for AI and potentially taking out the administrative elements of supply chain and focusing much more on what the insight can give us.
Do you think that developing science-based targets and heading towards the sustainable development goals, which are very much business-oriented, has that been a bit of a game-changer for you? Are businesses can see where they fit into the big picture?
I think understanding the big picture is really important, because I think that, again, goes back to almost what I was saying to you about modern slavery, is kind of you need to see the big picture to help you focus on where you're going to prioritise. When you distill what you get out of the science-based targets, it really helps you focus on what are the key priorities we can do to step change the business. Well, they are going to be about how we help people move from perhaps a meat-based diet to more of a plant-based diet is going to be key. It's going to be about how we decarbonize the energy sources. It is going to be about how we substantially reduce food waste. They're all going to be very key in driving the change. And really, that what science-based target does is it helps you to kind of identify what some of those key priorities are, and then what is it that you're going to do as a specific actions to significantly move things on.
Do you think that science-based targets go far enough? We had a debate last year at one of our events, our measurement event in Detroit, saying that, well, science-based targets have been based around everybody doing their bit to get to a 2 degrees Celsius maximum increase in temperatures. Now, given that everybody isn't going to do their bit, do you think there's an onus on progressive business to actually go beyond what a notional science-based target would be?
I think where we are at the moment is the science-based target for businesses that have worked it out feels pretty scary. So I think the key bit here is let's get on and make sure we deliver our part. Then when we've got a plan to deliver our part, then we can think about how we move on beyond it. And as you know, Ian, things evolve so fast, don't they? That actually what feels incredibly hairy and scary, just only a few couple of years down the line, becomes, oh, that's much more reasonable and achievable. And businesses like Marks & Spencer's will always be pushing the target on a bit further.
Let's think a little bit about technology then, particularly in terms of supply chain traceability. What are the kind of technological advances that you're seeing that really excite you around?
I think some of the technology that does excite me is around that which gives a more human element to thinking about supply chains. So some of the work that's, I don't know if you've seen BSR, have done an analysis of 199 technology advances for thinking about human rights and modern slavery. And I think you look down that list and there's some really quite interesting elements that I'd really recommend everyone had a look at. But I think what is very interesting is how few of those actually think about the role of work and having a really positive impact on work. Much more of them are about giving useful data for the end company. And I think what we need to do is to understand, how does technology do both? How does it give a greater voice? How does it enable the achievement of more rights, of a better job for people, as well as how does it deliver the traceability and the transparency? So I'm quite interested about those. I'm quite interested about the concept of what would enable the better transfer of money up and down the supply chain, again, without leakage appearing, so that people are guaranteed a fairer and transparent payment.
I guess we're talking about blockchain. It comes up in so many conversations these days. Or similar type technologies.
I think there is a lot of things called blockchain. Not all those things are equal. And I think, again, it's about really delving into it and understanding exactly what does the technology do that's so important. I think things like FaceTime a farmer are quite exciting. Mm-hmm. I think, again, anything that helps to better connect the ends of the supply chain together have got to be part of this much more disruptive solution.
Sure. But that is all part of the future of food, isn't it? Ensuring that every stage of the value chain gets their correct value out of it, that the farmers get paid properly, that they're viable businesses, and that every step of the way is a viable business. It ensures the continuity of supply that businesses like Marks & Spencer are so keen to insist or to make sure exist.
The one bit I was going to say to you to add to that is, I think some of the disruptive farming ideas are quite exciting. Not because necessarily they are the solution, but because I think they help get people to think differently. So I think the floating farm concept in Rotterdam is quite an exciting concept, that you're going from everything from growing the grass to producing the finished yogurt with the whole milking process in the middle. I think just because it helps to get people to think about what does a circular approach look like in food. I think people are getting their heads around vertical farming, which involves fish farming and produce production. And I don't think we've necessarily understand which ones will be the things that could be rolled into a much more large scale production. But I think they're getting people thinking about this much more circular approach to food.
What is the floating farm? That's not something I've come across.
Have you not? It's a really interesting concept. But basically, it's growing grass from seed. It's feeding the cattle, it's then milking them, and then it is producing yogurt production from it, and it's packing the yogurts, and it's all occurring in Rotterdam, right in the middle of the city, on the river.
Gosh. And I guess that's sort of exciting technology that will really engage consumers. Coming back to an earlier point, do you think they get the need for the evolution that's going to have to be in food supply chains to ensure that we're all going to get fed?
I think we have to recognise that there are some consumers who are growing up in an urban environment, very disconnected from where food is grown, how it is grown. I mean, there have been various surveys, haven't they, about children just not having any concept where meat and egg and milk come from. So I think there is a job to do, that kind of reconnecting and that different level of education. And I go back to, what are we trying to do with the plastic piece with Wastebusters, is absolutely about how do you educate both in store. Is the job to be done? Do I really want to move away from wrapped to unwrapped? Do I understand why that's important? Through to how do we engage kids so that the conversations are happening at the dinner table in the evening to get people thinking about what their change looks like. And we need to do that much more broadly around thinking about food. And I think, you know, you look at the Eat Lancet report that came out. That's again about how do you change that dynamic in the way that people engage with food, and that they recognise that what they eat has health implications for them, but it also has major implications for the planet. So it's about that whole connecting towards sustainable diets.
And what are going to be the push and pull factors then that will get people to accepting that their diets need to change?
Part of this is about, again, how do we make this less scary? How do we take people with us? So you might have seen that M&S launched Plant Kitchen, 60 new lines that were vegan, really first retailer to introduce that kind of scale of vegan range. And the reason there is it's about making this much more accessible. It's delicious food that without realising you're eating a vegan-based diet. And I think part of it is people just don't know what to do with products. So it's really hard to think about it. So what was great, again, back to being in Tolworth this morning, is people were having the conversations in the aisles about, well, what do you do with fennel? Or will I slice it raw and put it in my salad? And I think that's how do we help people to reconnect and to have some more of those conversations about the connection of food.
So just looking forwards then, are those the sort of conversations that are giving you cause for optimism that we will get, we will have sustainable supply chains for food?
I believe we will have, but do I think we have a tremendous journey to go on? Oh, yes, we do. Will it be something where brands and government and NGOs have to work together with the extended supply chain, with customers to help with that reconnection? Absolutely.
There's a lot to do, and there's a lot of work to do as well, not just on food, on modern slavery, on packaging and everything else. But Louise Nichols from Marks & Spencer, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
For more insight and debate on the future of food, don't forget to register this week for best price passes for the London conference on 4th and 5th of June. But that's it for now. I've been Ian Welsh, and I'll be back next week.